So for the sake of argument, let's take the first 3 months as a baseline. We know they can hit 90%, give or take. They're capable of it. Let's say they could have or should have continued that level of performance indefinitely.
But they didn't, O'Donnell said.
Exactly. They could have, but they didn't. What's the result?
Nagley said.
More misses later than earlier.
How many more?
I don't know.
I do,
Dixon said.
On this volume, if they had continued their baseline success rate through the final 4 months, they would have saved themselves exactly 650 extra misses.
Really? Really? Dixon said.
Numbers don't lie, and percentages are numbers. Something happened at the end of month 3 that went on to cost them 650 avoidable future failures.
Reacher nodded. A total of 183 days, a total of 2,197 events, a total of 1,314 successes and 883 failures, but with markedly unequal distribution. The first 3 months, 897 events, 802 successes, 95 failures. The next 4 months, 1,300 events, a miserable 502 successes, a catastrophic 798 failures, 650 of which wouldn't have happened if something hadn't changed.
I wish we knew what we were looking at, he said.
Sabotage, O'Donnell said.
Someone got paid to screw up something.
At $100,000 a time,
Nagley said.
650 times over?
That's nice work if you can get it.
Can't be sabotage, Reacher said. You could get a whole factory or office or whatever torched for $100,000, easy. Probably a whole town. You wouldn't have to pay per occasion.
So what is it?
I don't know.
But it ties in,
Dixon said, doesn't it? There was a definite mathematical relationship between what Franz knew and what Sanchez knew. A minute later, Reacher stepped to Dixon's window and looked out at the view, asked, Would it be fair to assume that Orozco knew whatever Sanchez knew?
Totally, O'Donnell said. And vice versa, certainly. They were friends. They worked together. They must have talked all the time.
So all we're missing is what Swan knew. We've got fragments from the other three, nothing from him.
His house was clean, nothing there.
So it's at his office.
He didn't have an office. He was canned.
But only very recently. So his office is just sitting there empty. They're shedding staff, not hiring, so there's no pressure on space. His office is mothballed, with his computer still right there on his desk. And maybe there are notes in the desk drawer, stuff like that. Nagley said,
You want to go see the Dragon Lady again?
I think we have to.
We should call before we drive all the way out there.
Better if we just show up.
I'd like to see where Swan worked,
O'Donnell said.
Me too,
Dixon said. Dixon drove. Her rental, her responsibility. She headed east on Sunset, hunting the 101. Nagley told her what she was going to have to do after that. A complex route, slow traffic. But the ride through Hollywood itself was picturesque. Dixon seemed to enjoy it. She liked L.A. The man in the dark blue suit in the dark blue Chrysler tailed them all the way. Outside the KTLA studios, just before the freeway, he dialed his phone, told his boss,
They're heading east, all four of them together in the car.
His boss said,
I'm still in Colorado. Watch them for me, okay?
Chapter 35 Dixon turned in through New Age's open gate and parked in the same visitor slot Nagley had used, head-on against the shiny corporate cube. The lot was still half-empty. The specimen trees were motionless in the heavy air. The same receptionist was on duty. Same polo shirt, same slow response. She heard the doors open, but didn't look up until Reacher put his hand on the counter.
Help you?
She said.
We need to see Ms. Berenson again, Reacher said. The human resources person?
I'll see if she's available,
the receptionist said.
Please take a seat.
O'Donnell and Nagley sat down, but Reacher and Dixon stayed on their feet. Dixon was too restless to spend more of the day in a chair. Reacher stood because if he sat next to Nagley, he would crowd her, and if he sat somewhere else, she would wonder why. They waited the same 4 minutes before they heard the click of Berenson's heels on the slate. She came out of the corridor and around the corner and didn't hesitate, just gave the receptionist a nod of thanks and passed her by and headed on out. She gave up two types of smiles, one kind to Reacher and Nagley because she had met them before, and another kind to O'Donnell and Dixon because she hadn't. She shook hands all around. Same scars under the makeup, same icy breath. She opened the aluminum door and stood still until everyone had filed past her into the conference room. With five people in it, the room was short one chair, so Berenson stood by the window, polite, but also psychologically dominating. It made her visitors look upward at her, and it made them squint against the light behind her. She said,
"How may I help you today?"
There was a little condescension in her voice, a little irritation, a slight emphasis on today. "Tony Swan is missing," Reacher said.
"Missing?"
"As in we can't find him."
"I don't understand."
"It's not a difficult concept to grasp."
"But he could be anywhere.
A new job out of state, or a long-delayed vacation, somewhere he always wanted to go. People sometimes do that in Mr. Swan's circumstances,
like a silver lining."
O'Donnell said, "His dog died of thirst, trapped inside his house. No silver lining there, all cloud. Swan didn't go anywhere he planned to go."
"His talk. How awful."
"Roger that," Dixon said.
"Her name was Maisie,"
Nagley said.
"I don't see how I can help,"
Berenson said. "Mr. Swan left here more than 3 weeks ago. Isn't this a matter for the police?"
"They're working on it," Reacher said. "We're working on it, too."
"I don't see how I can help."
"We'd like to see his desk and his computer. And his diary. There might be notes, or information, or appointments."
"Notes about what?"
"About whatever has caused him to be missing."
"He's not missing because of New Age."
"Maybe not, but people have been known to conduct private business during office hours. People have been known to jot down notes about things from their outside lives."
"Not here."
"Why not? You're all business all the time."
"There are no notes here. No paper at all. No pens or pencils. Basic security. This is a completely paperless environment.
Much safer. It's a rule. Anyone even thinks about breaking it, they get fired. Everything is done on computers here. We have an in-house network with secure firewalls and automatic random data monitoring."
"Can we see his computer then?" Nagley asked.
"I guess you could see it," Berenson said.
"But it won't do you any good. Someone leaves here, within 30 minutes their desktop hard drive is taken out and destroyed. Smashed. Physically, with hammers. It's another security rule."
"With hammers?" Reacher said.
"It's the only definitive method. Data can be recovered otherwise."
"So there's no trace of him left?"
"None at all, I'm afraid."
"You've got some pretty heavy rules here."
"I know. Mr. Swan designed them himself in his first week. They were his first major contribution."
"Did he talk to anybody?" Dixon asked. "Water cooler buddies? Is there anyone he would have shared a concern with?"
"Personal issues?" Berenson said. "I doubt it. The dynamic wouldn't have been appropriate. He had to play a cop's role here. He had to keep himself a little unapproachable to be effective."
"What about his boss?" O'Donnell said. "They might have shared they were in the same boat, professionally."
"I'll certainly ask him,"
Berenson said.
"But what's his name?" "I can't tell you that."
"Well, you're very discreet."
Mr. Swan insisted on it.
Can we meet with the guy?
He's out of town right now.
So who's minding the store?
Mr. Swan is, in a way. His procedures are all still in place.
Did he talk to you?
About personal things?
No, he really didn't. Was he upset or worried the week he left?
Not that I saw.
Was he making a lot of phone calls?
I'm sure he was.
We all do.
What do you think might have happened to him?
Me?
Berenson said. I really have no idea. I walked him to his car, and I said when things pick up again, I'll be on the phone begging him to come back. And he said he'd look forward to my call. That was the last I saw of him.
They got back in Dixon's car and reversed away from the mirror glass. Reacher watched the Ford's reflection get smaller and smaller. Negley said,
"Wasted trip. I told you we should have called."
Dixon said,
"I wanted to see where he worked."
O'Donnell said,
"Worked is the wrong word. They were using him there, that's all. They picked his brains for a year and then kicked him out. They were buying his ideas, not giving him a job."
"Sure looks that way," Negley said.
"They're not making anything there. It's an unsecured building."
"Obviously. They must have a third place somewhere, a remote plant for manufacturing."
"So why didn't UPS get that address, too?"
"Maybe it's secret. Maybe they don't get mail there."
"I'd like to know what they make."
"Why?"
Dixon asked.
"Just curious. The more we know, the luckier we get."
Reacher said, "So go ahead and find out."
"I don't know anyone to ask."
"I do,"
Negley said.
"I know a guy in Pentagon procurement."
Reacher said, "Call him." In his room in his Denver hotel, the dark-haired 40-year-old, calling himself Alan Mason, was concluding his meeting. His guest had shown up exactly on time and had been accompanied by a single bodyguard. Mason had taken both of those facts as positive signs. He appreciated punctuality in business, and being outnumbered only 2-1 was a luxury. Often he was alone with as many as 6 or 10 on the other side of the deal. So, a good start. It had been followed by substantive progress. No lame excuses about late delivery or lowered numbers or other difficulties, no bait and switch, no attempt to renegotiate, no jacked up prices. Just the sale, as previously discussed, 650 units at $100,000 each. Mason had opened his suitcase, and his client had started the long process of totaling the consideration inside. The Swiss bank balances and the bearer bonds were uncontroversial. They had reliable face values. The diamonds were more subjective. Carat weight was a given, of course, but much depended on cut and clarity. Mason's people had in fact underestimated in order to build in a horse trading margin. Mason's guest quickly understood. He pronounced himself entirely satisfied, and agreed that the suitcase did indeed contain $65 million, at which point it became his suitcase. In exchange, Mason received a key and a piece of paper. The key was small, old, scratched and worn, plain and unlabeled. It looked like the kind of thing a hardware store cuts while a person waits. Mason was told it was the key to a padlock currently securing a shipping container waiting at the Los Angeles docks. The piece of paper was a bill of lading, describing the shipping container's contents as 650 DVD players. Mason's guest and his bodyguard left, and Mason stepped into the bathroom and set fire to his passport in the toilet pan. A half hour later, Andrew McBride left the hotel and headed back to the airport. He was surprised to realize that he was looking forward to hearing the jug band music again. Frances Negley called Chicago from the back of Dixon's car. She told her assistant to email her contact at the Pentagon and explain that she was out of the office,
in California, away from a secure phone, and that she had an inquiry about New Age's product. She knew her guy would feel better about responding by email than talking on an unsecured cell network. O'Donnell said, "Do you have secure phones in your office?"
"Sure."
"Outstanding. Who's the guy?"
"Just a guy," Negley